Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, a minute past the hour on this, the 18th day of October 2012. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday. Yes, indeed it is. How did we get Thursday in such a dadgum hurry? But we did. The Horn is available in a wide variety of manners, methods, platforms. You choose it. The easiest way to get The Horn is, of course, and why am I telling you this? You're listening. But you never know. Somebody might just be happening on. The easiest thing is to simply go to headonradionetwork.com. Or, of course, you can also find us on a variety of portable apps for your smartphone, things like TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Internet Radio, Tuner Internet Radio, Dar.fm, Streama.com. Whole bunch of others. So we try to make it as easy to get as something that isn't on the terrestrial censored airwaves possibly can be. You can get the podcasting XML feed over at whiterosesociety.org under my show file, Head On with Bob Kincaid. And the podcasts are also available at iTunes. Now, let me start out by saying again thank you to everybody who made last night such a magnificent success. We drew up to where we need to be on the 18th day of October 2012. And you could argue that we've even gotten a little further down the road. So thank you very kindly. Because all of this happens by virtue of your contributions. Not occasionally, but in the past, Agnes and I have made up a lot of shortfalls, but as I explained some time back, changes in the revenue stream have made that impossible now. And so the continued success, the continued survival of The Horn is contingent entirely upon listener contributions. Thank you for everything you did last night. And in fact, we're on track to beat the Swede pretty early, and the Swede would, of course, like to be beaten again. We had a communication from the Swede, in other words, our buddy Scott. He sends me emails like this just because he enjoys tormenting me sometimes. It's all full of vowels with strange symbols over the top of them. But you may recall the other night the word niggardly appeared in the course of a piece of correspondence. Scott's email begins, "Hey, Bob or Rebob." I like that. "Here I am, just a-minding my own business, and yours, as I had my own run-in with a Belgian bastard who happens to be Jordanian, but like Mitt Romney, facts are etch-a-sketchable, or, as the first of the wretched R's called them, stupid things." You remember when Ronnie Reagan said, well, you know what they say, facts are stupid things. Hey. "My Belgium bastard ran a fake translation company," Scott says, "and stole $3,000 worth of my work, and now I'm working extra hours to recoup the losses." God, that sucks. Nothing is either safe nor sacred anymore. Those Belgians do get around, though. I bet you this Jordanian was born in, you know, Antwerp or somewhere. He probably skipped away after he stole the translations too, Scott. Anyways, while pulling my ara on this dragon-headed langskep, what should come out of my skipare's horn but the claim that the word niggardly was Swedish in origin? Helvete, fad for fan. So, despite many mil to row before I sleep, I think I know what that was, I stowed my ara for a while and consulted the langusman, who is always found in the prow chipping away on a runsten, all about the planet Valhalla, where you go after you die and you get to mate with as many women, men, and sheep as you can afford. Which we were planning on kerplunking in Minnesota, don't you know? You betcha. Hey, if Joseph Smith could pull it off, why not we? It's not that the U.S. population has a very widespread high credibility threshold, does it? Well, Spiala, the skip's resident, Langusman, knows about all this sort of thing, having first been a himoiki. This is like one of those, when I was a kid, every so often some state troopers would show up in the most popular DJ's booth with a fifth of liquor, and they would do that experiment where you get the DJ drunk to prove how dangerous it is to drink and drive, because if you can't even be trusted to spin records loaded, well, you probably shouldn't be operating an automobile. And it was fun because it got progressively worse and worse and worse, and there was, you know, it was kind of innocent. This is like that. Just throwing things like skipares. Who knows? Well, Spiala, the skip's resident Langusman knows all about this sort of thing, as we noted. Spiala says you have it wrong. The word comes from the Vastfolk, or Norsemen, Norwegians. Now I'll get notes from Norway. Not the Ostfolk, or Svea, Swedes. Their word, nigra, meant to be a stingy person, and evolved into the modern word gnicke, to be miserly, stingy. We Swedes say schnall, or schnalla. And I'm mangling the pronunciations here. With a completely different etymology, so it is plainly seen, don't blame us. Now then, this word via the Norse made it to your Scottish ancestors. See how it winds up being my fault? There on the north half of the British Isles, to become niggle, which would have been pronounced nigle before the stress migrated to the first syllable, gutfitnar. Gutfitnar. I keep seeing V, and I want to pronounce it like a German V, which is an F. Now, as to whether all the skos are nigla, as is said about them, whether the Scots are skoskornidla, as is said about them, I'll leave for others, but in my experience, the Jordanians may be even much more nigretiga on an admittedly limited sample of one. So yes, the word is ancient and comes via the northern branches of Indo-European, while that other word, the Voldemort, i.e. the Vikingr god Hel, no mysteries there, huh, of words, i.e. the word that shall not be uttered, comes to us from the southern branch of the Indi-Uris via Latin. Now I have to put my ara back into the hav and row like a galning to be able to cheerfully pay up should my fellow hornies fill the month's goal. We can do it if we all drega till salmons on the Aurore. I'm sorry. If we all draga till salmons on the Aurore. That may be my, what's the word here? That may be my skosker making all those rrr. Finally, after we kerplunk the rock in Sota, I'm retroactively baptizing all the hornies, living, dead, and otherwise, into the Asatron. So start polishing your battle axes, hornies, put on your torques, and start learning your runes. Signed, Scott. P.S. We got any lawyers out there who passed the bar in Jordan? Scott is so good at this kind of stuff. First of all, how do you find out that your translation's been ripped off? Then how do you find out it's been ripped off by a Jordanian, who apparently has roots in Belgium, thieving bastards? And then ultimately, what do you do about it? So anybody with any international law skills on stolen intellectual property, please contact Scott via me, and I will hook the two of you up. He could use a little help. And as he notes, he stands ready to be a Swede beaten if we can reach the fundraising goal before the end of the month. By the way, remember what shall we call them? The Arkansas Triumvirate of Fuqua, Hubbard, and Doofus? I can't remember the third guy's name. These were the ones who wanted a credible death threat for the business of child rearing. Wanted us to all understand that persons of color in this country ought to be a hell of a lot more grateful to we white people whose ancestors kidnapped them and brought them hither. Yeah, you know, that just most everybody who read those stories thought, my goodness gracious, what an antediluvian moron. What an idiot. Who says crap like that, you know? I mean, almost all of us. Emphasis on the word almost. I have been meditating, if you will, of late, on that famous passage from the New Testament in which the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer Yeshua remarked, "The poor ye have always with ye." Because I like him so much better in the original King James Elizabethan English that wasn't even being spoken at the time the King James Version was written, but they used the Elizabethan English because it sounds so much more poetic and, you know, gaudy. The poor ye have always with ye. This has meaning. And in the context of that, the context of that verse has always been taken to have a rather particular meaning. It comes from Matthew chapter 26. And, it's a story of when Jesus was taking a break. It starts with verse 6 of chapter 26. This is not prayer meeting Wednesday. I'm getting to a point here. Now, when Jesus was in Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, you know you're hard up for a place to stay. I mean, all those right-wing, evangelical fundamentalist prosperity gospel, Jesus took up his machine gun, did go and slay the Romans kind of people, the ones who read that conserva Bible. I'm guessing they missed the part where he's hanging out in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. If Simon the leper had a house in Bethany, I'm guessing Bethany was not a great neighborhood either. Now, when Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment. You'll notice it was a box and not a binder. And poured it on his head. That's not a very nice thing to do. Well, maybe it was. As he sat at meat. Would that be, I don't know what the preposition would be, Scott, in Sweden, but would that be at mot? Trying to learn my Swedish here, dadgummit. As he sat at meat. No, it was not pulled pork barbecue, darn it. But when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, "To what purpose is this waste?" Again, this is where the Elizabethan English creates a little bit of a problem. Because what they said is, "What the f*** are you doing? For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor. And there you are just dumping it on his head." And you can imagine Jesus, who's sitting having dinner and just gets some gobbledygook poured over the top of his head. And that takes a couple of minutes. Yeah, one of those. So in verse 10, we see, when Jesus understood it, in other words, when everybody was done hollering, why are you pouring crap on our Lord's head, even expensive, sweet-smelling crap, he said unto them, why trouble ye the woman? For she hath wrought a good work upon me. For the poor ye have always with ye, but me ye have not always. For in that she hath poured this ointment on my body, and she did it for my burial. Verily I say unto you, whosoever the gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this, that this woman hath done, be told for a memorial of her. And lo and behold, here we are, it's the 18th day of October 2012, and she liveth on. Because it may not necessarily mean what we think it means. The poor ye have always with you. What poor? Well, here they say that we could have sold this for much and given it to the poor. Well, that other prophet, William Charles Duncan Fields, used to once said, I love to give to the poor. Poor me. That's one of those things in fairly well-developed languages where you can use an adjective and not necessarily have to have it the noun that it modifies actually come afterward in order to understand what is meant, but sometimes the meaning gets muddied. Poor what? Poor whom? The poor ye have always with ye. Does that necessarily mean impecunious people? Some would say that the context of the statement there indicates yes. But I would say that it does not. Y'all are incorrigible. I don't know where you get it, but you are. I read Scott and Sweden's letter, the first thing I hear. Ron and Raleigh, time to play one of those Swedish chef clips, which was followed in the mailbox immediately by Randy, flurg de flurg. Bork, bork, bork. And then I move into the Holy Scriptures, holy cow, and here comes Michael. Did they just put the lotion on his skin? And then Ron and Raleigh figures out what the lotion was. Hey, Bob, I know what it was. That ointment was Afro Sheen because Yeshua was said to have hair that was dark and woolly. There's a point here. There is a point here. And that is this. Poor what? Because there are other passages where he uses poor and he uses words afterward. During, for instance, the Beatitudes. We'll take that as read. Poor what? I have been compelled to consider of late that poor, in the absence of poor people, poor men, poor women, poor folks, that we are free to interpret what poor means. And in light of the number of morons that Yeshua had to deal with on any given day, granted, he was loving and kind and only occasionally insanely frustrated with them. You all get crowns, okay? Everybody gets a crown. Now, next topic. We're free to... And poor of spirit? Yeah, I use that phrase, poor in spirit. But given the number of morons that he dealt with on a routine basis, I think we have no choice but to recognize that he may have meant poor of mind, poor of brain. You know, idiots. Because I mentioned that Arkansas Troika a few minutes ago. See? I don't just wander off into the weeds. I was going somewhere. Everybody pretty much understood that those were three bloomin' idiots. Unreconstructed neo-Confederates. Oh, well, we kidnapped them, but we gave them Jesus. You know, the ones that survived. At least one guy missed the memo. And it is no surprise at all that the one guy who missed the memo was Texas's own. Sorry, Edward. Sorry, Beth. Sorry, everybody. Texas's own pig-licking Louis Gohmert. Not understanding that the issue had proven toxic to the Arkansas Troika, Louis Gohmert just had to chime in. Oh, Michael. They put the lotion on his head or else he gets the cross again. Are people moving away from you on the street right now? Oh, jump. No, Louis Gohmert didn't get it. Didn't get the memo on let's leave slavery alone between now and the election. There was this thing called 40 Days to Save America. I think we discussed this at one point in time. Pastor Rick Scarborough come up with it. And it was called, going to fast and pray. Remember when I told you the story about the radio segment I heard on the way home from D.C., where they fasted and prayed and marched around the side of the new dormitory, and they fasted and prayed to hustle a little real estate on an unsuspecting purchaser? It's part of that. 40 days to save America. And they enlisted fine, upstanding, right-wing Texas Christian Louis Gohmert to join in on a conference call. Now, this is a direct quote of what Louis Dunn said on that there 40 Days to Save America conference call. There is so much that is so critical to whether or not this country continues. No explanation as to why we've been so blessed, other than the people who went before us were blessed. They followed God's rule book. In our founding, they followed biblical teachings. Even though they didn't. We strayed away at different times. Andrew Jackson's time was not a great time. At different times, slavery was a blot on our existence. But the trouble is, we never have, as an entire nation, overall been so far away from God's teaching and so openly rebelling, even from the top, against God's teachings in the Bible. Really. Andrew Jackson's time was not a great time. In slavery, at different times, slavery was a blot on our existence. At different times. Sometimes it wasn't. If you have to say at different times that slavery was a blot on our existence, then some of the times it wasn't. I mean, there were times when slavery was a blot on our existence, and then there were times when slavery was not only not a blot on our existence, but as South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun said, a good thing, ordained by God. But understand that even though Andrew Jackson's time was not a great time, and even though slavery was sometimes a blot on our existence, just a blot, that at no time, the trouble is, we have never as an entire nation overall been so far away from God's teaching and so openly rebelling, even from the top, against God's teachings in the Bible. By even from the top, he means, you know, that one in our White House. My gracious sakes. Civil War didn't make the list. Andrew Jackson's time was not a great time. Well, what do you say about that little dust-up in 1861? A few hundred thousand, you know, Americans. It's a statistic. I confess, I don't understand them. I can't get it. How can you be so utterly blinded by your own white privilege that you cannot compel yourself to say that the single greatest evil that has ever beset this nation was the fact that from its founding until 1865, the engine of a significant portion of our economy ran on human bondage and on an entire economy based on the buying and selling of human beings? What's wrong with your brain, Louis Gohmert? Dadgum. But it's a problem that is pervasive. I go back to a segment from, what, the 1970s? And the Mormon prophet John Taylor being interviewed by Mike Wallace. Witness it.
It's the old eternal battle, the forces of evil against the forces of good. It's the old eternal battle, the forces of evil against the forces of good. It's the old eternal battle, the forces of evil against the forces of good.
Okay.
Eternal battle. The forces of evil against the forces of good. Forces of good.
From 1830 to 1978, blacks could not become priests in the Mormon Church, right?
That's correct.
Why?
Because the leaders of the church at that time interpreted that doctrine that way.
Church policy had it that blacks had the mark of Cain. Brigham Young said, Cain slew his brother, and the Lord put a mark upon him, which is the flat nose and black skin.
It's behind us. Look, that's behind us. Don't worry about those little flicks of history. It's the old eternal battle, the forces of evil against the forces of good.
Yeah, it's behind us. Behind us. That's why Louis Gohmert in the year 2012 says that slavery was a blot on our existence, but then, well, right. Beth writes in and says, Bob, I'm still waiting for the punchline. That's just boilerplate Louis. And where's his brain? I'm afraid the Amber Alert on that expired a long time ago. Yeah, ain't nobody pouring nothing on his head. Ain't no head to pour it on. Marty noting, leaving out, of course, the near genocide of the first peoples. Yeah, there's that. Well, that's what he means when he says that Andrew Jackson's presidency was not a great time. But that leaves it open for it to still be, you know, a good time. It was had by all. Well, except, all the people who weren't four-fifths of a person, you know, like that. No, it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and Thorn in the Side Thursday is reserved for things that make us more than a little bit crazy. Things that just feel like they were sent to torment us. No, not that one. Here's one. Let's get away from the religious. This story had a little bit of resonance for me, because I remember back when I used to cook a lot more than I do now. I still do some, but not as much. But when they were little, say, first, second, and third grade, Margie, Ferg, and Doodle loved to take their lunch. Because after all, who wants to eat downer cattle chili or downer cattle pizza? And so we'd try to make them, Agnes and I, good nutritious things. And I remember one evening, and I'd done it a few times beforehand, I hand-rolled some sushi for them. Set it up in a lunch carrier so that it would stay nice and cool until lunchtime for them. You know, nothing ornate. You know, no sea urchin roe or anything like that. Just some nice tuna with some avocado. I got the sticky rice and I did it with the vinegar and tossed it and everything. I made pretty good sushi back in the day. And so Ferg and Margie and Doodle did not eat all at the same time when lunchtime came. Margie ate her sushi, no problem. Ferg, Doodle ate hers, no problem. Poor little Ferg sits down, unwraps his tuna rolls. You know, I'd even rolled them in toasted sesame. I mean, they were nice. And his teacher came up to him.
What do you think you're eating? Sushi, ma'am. That's disgusting. You go and you throw that away right now. And you go and tell your parents not to ever send that in your lunch again. I'll not have that in my school or in my lunchroom. You're liable to make the other children sick.
He was a little fella then, easily hurt. And his eyes welled up with tears. And he went and threw his lunch away. Broke his heart.
Now you go get yourself a tray of normal food.
Yes, ma'am. Obviously, I still remember this. I'm still angry about it. Well, it turns out, and this story was published a scant 6 days ago over at a blog called The Healthy Home Economist,
The story comes from Newport Beach, California. A child was suspended from school because the child's mommy packed a healthy lunch that included a container, a glass container wrapped in foam, of kombucha. Kombucha is a fermented tea product that is just loaded with stuff that's really good for your insides. And the child liked it. The lunch police, however, noticed, you know, I read this with a certain degree of camaraderie, thinking, well, Jesus, at least it's not a story out of West Virginia. The lunch police confiscated the glass bottle, took the child to the principal's office, subjected the child to questioning in the presence of uniformed and armed police officers, and then suspended the child for violation of the school's drug and alcohol policy. Because there is a trace amount of alcohol by virtue of the fermentation process in kombucha. The police officer lectured the child and said that kombucha is an illegal and very dangerous substance. The vice principal told the little fella, "We might have to transfer you out of this school." And then tried to enroll the child in, believe it or not, a 12-step program for teen alcoholics. The entire school day was spent in the school office, at which point they imposed a 5-day suspension on the little fella for violating the school's drug and alcohol policy. You know, because a trace amount of alcohol in kombucha is exactly the same thing as if he had brought a big bag of blunts to school. Or, I don't know, maybe some bath salts or some crack or some meth. At no point in time, as is noted in this blog post, was the kombucha even tested for exactly what the alcohol content was. The school district realized that it had stepped in it. The suspension was lifted, and everything was declared okay. Meanwhile, however, this child was subjected to an entire day of grilling and harassment over the beverage that he had. For his lunch. Now, Marty asking, now, did the police really know what that really is? I'm guessing no. He also says, this is why I dislike zero tolerance policies. Story has engendered from Ron and Raleigh a great big say. What? Wouldn't sauerkraut have the same problem? Well, yes. Or homemade pickles. On the other hand, the child would, I'm sure, was free to go and get a plate of genetically modified pink slime-infused gruel, you know, pseudo-chicken nuggets. Parts is parts, after all. Don't ever, I mean ever, take it from me, ever, don't ever go to YouTube and look up mechanically separated meat. What has been seen cannot be unseen. And you don't want to see this even if your gallbladder is healthy or even gone. You don't want to see it. I know there is a lot. We've got a presidential election to worry about. We've got a Senate to worry about whether we're going to maintain control of it. Faint and distant hopes of regaining the House of Representatives. But I keep. Other things are in the back of my mind. Prop 37 in California is huge to me. And I will be curious to see what happens if people of California rise up against Monsanto. Because Big Food has a vested interest in all this crap. And speaking of Big Food, this is Thorn in the Side Thursday. I offer this, I suppose, as a way of an excuse. Every show under the sun, just about, is at some point in time going to be talking presidential politics. The top two or three or four or five stories of the day. There are very few programs where you can get something that is outside the usual suspects. And the folks who listen to this program generally know where to find those programs themselves. So I don't necessarily feel like it is incumbent upon me to do. I mean, we talked about the binders full of women and everything. I like to go off the beaten path once in a while. Even if sometimes the beaten path leads me to places that I had no idea even existed. I mean, my God. What has not been outsourced in this country? We've outsourced paper mills. We've outsourced auto parts manufacturing. We are never going to see a smartphone manufactured in the United States of America, as President Obama noted. Some of those jobs are gone and they're not coming back. I mean, really, do we want a Foxconn factory in the United States? Do we want a great big high-rise dormitory building with nets around it to catch the jumpers who are so dismayed by their working conditions that they're willing to commit suicide? Because the only way the Foxconn jobs are ever coming back to the United States is if labor standards are utterly eliminated in this country and American workers are allowed to be treated like Chinese workers are treated. Right? We've outsourced, I think about News Ninja Susan. She was tech support, I think, she said once upon a time with, was it HP, Susan? Did I not say Prop 37? Oh, okay, yeah. Michael says Prop 37 polling about 2-1, yes, 3 yes votes in our little ramshackle alone. Good. I mean, there's nothing in this country that has not been outsourced. We've outsourced the sewing of underwear. We've outsourced every, and we finally found one more thing to outsource. We've outsourced the food. It blows my mind and has ever since, like back in 2004, when I first saw that story that said we had become a net importer of food into the United States, which just scared me. But we've even outsourced the ideas for food. That is getting pretty well, what do you call that, bottom of the barrel? Philosophical? Metaphysical? Metafoodical? The clown, the king, and Jared are not now all outsourcers. Of course, I can't even think about Subway without getting something near sick. There's enough maltodextrin, and we had the story a couple of years ago about Subway's bread, and it's just bleh. But I asked the question, you know, how do you steal intellectual property in talking about Scott and Sweden's dilemma? It turns out that something as prosaic as the creation of a burger is really, no kidding, intellectual property. So here's how the dodge works if you're Subway, if you're McDonald's, if you're Burger King. When you come up with the McSlimy, that intellectual property has value. You, as the hypothetical head of Great Big Burger Corporation of America, recognize this, and it imposes upon you certain tax liabilities. What do you do? Here's what you do. You call the tax accounting office, and you say, get me Wimblesnip in accounting. Yes, sir. Wimblesnip! I want us to reduce our tax liabilities for the new McSlimy. Yes, sir. So before you can say, have it your way, a tax haven company has been created in one of those BS, low-tax, tax haven, tax dodge countries. Wherein you lodge the intellectual property rights to the brand new McSlimy that you're going to foist off on an unsuspecting public. In this country, there has been a growing movement toward what is called locavoreism, trying to eat locally. Whenever on those incredibly rare occasions we eat somewhere besides here, we try to eat in the local establishments around here. We've got a Subway 2 miles away from here, but we've also got a mom-and-pop place that does as good or better a job. Across the river, there's a cool little restaurant culture going down. That has a great sandwich place, one of the best pizza places I've ever been in, an awesome breakfast coffee place, a wonderful seafood joint, good Mexican place. And we try to go to one of those because the owners are local, the workers are local, and we know that they're sourcing their food as carefully as they can because they don't have 1,000 other stores against which to balance any mistakes. I'm also much less likely to see one of those obnoxious Friends of Cole stickers in one of these local places. So when you go, when you make eating out choices, even if you know maybe you're traveling and you just need to grab something on the fly. Yeah, there are apps out there for your phones and stuff now that you can and find. What's the name? Lottie told me about one from the chat room. The Grubhub, I think. You don't have to support this. When you go through McDonald's, when you go through Wendy's, when you go through Burger... Okay, McDonald's, Burger King, and Subway are the ones that I have, for instance, immediately in front of me. The creation of the new McSlimey, for instance, is classified as intellectual property. And then, since you on the ground are paying a franchise fee back to the mothership in order to serve the McSlimey, you pay an intellectual property fee for the McSlimey as well. It's not just a McSlimey, it's intellectual property. And that's what lets you use the new McSlimey logo. But when you send the check off for the fees, you send the check in the case of Subway, you send it to, I think, Sweden? There, Switzerland. Switzerland. Sorry, Scott. When you, the franchisee, send off your intellectual property franchise payments for the king, the thing, you send it to Zug, Switzerland, where the tax rate is between 2 and 12%, according to this report by Tom Bergen for Reuters. The fee, if remitted in the United States, would be 35 to 39%. Oh, I'm sorry. I was mistaken. No, if you send your franchise fee in to Jared, Jared lost all that weight and he's feeling pretty good about himself because he's hanging out in Curacao. Really. Curacao. Man, we'll worry about it tomorrow. Just file all the checks. Starbucks uses this Dodge. It's quite the handy little ruse. If you want to go and find the article, it's called Fast Food Tax Light. Tom Bergen reporting from London in a story dated Monday, October the 15th for Reuters. He writes, it's hard to know how widespread this practice is. Tax experts say the use of intellectual property or royalty fees has existed for decades, but spread after a U.S. loophole opened in the 1990s. The fees first appeared in McDonald's U.K. accounts in 2007. The U.K. until 2011 paid £62 million, 4 to 5% of its turnover in such fees. McDonald's European headquarters is also in Switzerland. Yeah. The tentacles of greed and absolutely unpatriotic tax avoidance have reached into every corner of our existence. The only hope that you or I have to try to behave as responsible members of an aware, what do we call ourselves, consumerate? Is to try to find those places where we can eat locally and to try to do enough due diligence. And what a damn shame that you have to do due diligence to make sure that you're not participating in overt evil just because you want a cheeseburger. Try to do our due diligence and understand what, you know, because you're not, it ain't just a burger. It just doesn't sound, quite as enticing to say, let's go have some intellectual property and fries. But if I ever get down that way again, I'm going to make sure that I'm in Florence, Alabama, along about lunchtime, and I'm going to go to Staggs' Grocery down in the last fading vestiges of East Florence. And I'm going to get there the best hamburger you have ever eaten in your life. And yes, I will put this up against anybody. All those things I like best tend to come from places where people really care about. I don't remember waxing rhapsodic about any corporate offerings. Nor, I suspect, do you. But this is what it means to be awake and alert in a culture that is designed entirely to do nothing more than transfer capital and make as limited as possible any value returned in exchange. Andy with a note says in an email titled Prop 37 GMO Labeling. Note, I worked a table this weekend at the Half Moon Bay Pumpkin Festival for the Prop 37 campaign. The $32 million anti-Prop 37 propaganda is working. When we first started this endeavor, 90% of those polled were for GMO labeling. A few weeks ago, it shrank to 64%. Now it's 48.3% in favor of labeling, Pepperdine, according to a Pepperdine University poll. Unfortunately, we're losing. Never underestimate the influence of big money to throw doubt, fear, and indecision into the minds of our citizens. You know, the morons. The corporatists, Monsanto, DuPont, Bayer, Nestle, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Dean Foods, etc., are hitting us hard because they know this could be a big loss of profits for them if it passes. Edward L. Bernays' propaganda works. That's why they do it. A Stanford University Hoover Institute, Milton Friedman's last digs, dude, commercial in particular, is convincing people that the proposition is poorly written. By God, they didn't dot all their I's and cross all their T's, and I think they've got a comma splice in there. Also, it will cost us too much. It's another bit of misinformation among other arguments against us. Andy sent along an opposition document. This bill will cost California families billions in extra food costs. Families can expect $400 or more extra a year in food costs if Proposition 37 passes. Really? Labeling costs that much? The the proposition is deceptive. It's written by trial lawyers, and we should expect lawsuits like we did with Prop 65. Exemptions. They have no problem with labeling, but our proposition has too many loopholes. Looking for a loophole. Andy notes, somehow I think death from the toxic effects of GMOs cost us too much. One dude argued with me, don't you understand economics? Labeling costs us too much. Andy says, I responded, poor health costs us too much. I'm guessing the poor health costs more than, grim death. Grim death, more expensive than labeling, right? Or maybe I don't understand economics either. But this is good for bad for shareholders. Poor little shareholders. Marty asks, outsourcing the ideas for food. What, is Gordon Ramsay in charge of all that now? Yeah. He also says, give the Roberts Court a chance. We'll be there soon enough. Prop 37? Hell, I filed an early change of address card in order to sign the petition to get 37 onto the ballot. And then again, there is that aspect of it. At least you've got it on the ballot. We don't have referendum in this state. Of course, I can only imagine what a referendum on mountaintop removal, for instance, would be like. My home would probably be a heap of smoking rubble at this point. Yeah. So, here we are at the close of this Thorn in the Side Thursday filibobster. And I invite you heartily to participate in the conversation. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or on your nickel, 304-658-3333, if you don't need us to pay the toll-free freight. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, @gmail.com. I bet you even know what the bumper's going to be, don't you? Sure you do. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Have I? Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, October 18, 2012.
So he's got the oil and gas part, but he doesn't have the clean energy part.
I want to make sure we use our oil, our coal, our gas, our nuclear, our renewables.
The second presidential debate, debunking and fact-checking on energy. Plus,
having an energy conversation without talking about climate is like talking about smoking and not talking about cancer.
A no-show at the debate. Climate change.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
This has not been Mr. Oil or Mr. Gas or Mr. Coal.
Speaking of which, where's Mr. Freeze?
I'll be back.
Oh, yeah, there he is. This is your Green News Report.
The Iceman cometh.
Okay, Des, my cold persists, so my apologies for that. But another interesting debate this week, and right off the bat, it was all about energy and drilling and oil and more oil.
Oh, indeed. The candidates hit hard and heavy on energy at the second presidential town hall debate at Hofstra University.
Yeah, but no talk about climate change once again.
No, absolutely nothing, but we'll have more on that in a moment. Of course, there was lots of misleading stats and outright false claims. Now, there are too many to cover all of them right here, so please check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com, for a full energy-specific fact check and debunking. First, the very premise of the first question about how the administration can lower gas prices is just wrong. It's a fact that the price of oil is set on the global market, and there is almost nothing that any president can do to affect the price of gas. Obama knows this, and so does Governor Romney, but instead they made it into a contest for who loves fossil fuels more.
We still continue to open up new areas for drilling. We continue to make it a priority for us to go after natural gas.
More drilling, more permits and licenses. We're going to bring that pipeline in from Canada.
We're actually drilling more on public lands. We made the largest investment in clean coal technology.
I don't think anyone really believes that you're a person who's going to be pushing for oil and gas and coal. I will fight for oil, coal, and natural gas.
I'm all for pipelines. I'm all for oil production.
And both Obama and Romney pandered on gas prices, pretending that more drilling will have an effect on lowering gas prices. That's just not true. Romney's also just plain wrong that drilling on public lands is down. Fact checkers say that Romney was cherry-picking statistics. Drilling is actually higher, on average, on public lands now than during the Bush administration. Plus, neither one of them mentioned solar and wind projects on public lands.
And there's been, in fact, a huge increase in wind projects on federal lands. Zero projects on federal lands before Obama took office to, I think, 16 different projects now?
Yes, 16 different solar projects in just the last 4 years. Obama also pointed out that major difference on federal investment in the U.S. clean energy industry. You know, and our investment right now is already paltry compared to China and Germany.
So he's got the oil and gas part, but he doesn't have the clean energy part. And if we are only thinking about tomorrow or the next day and not thinking about 10 years from now, we're not going to control our own economic future. Because China, Germany, they're making these investments. And I'm not going to cede those jobs of the future to those countries. I expect those new energy sources to be built right here in the United States.
Now, Romney says he cares about renewable energy.
I want to make sure we use our oil, our coal, our gas, our nuclear, our renewables. I believe very much in our renewable capabilities, ethanol, wind, solar, be an important part of our energy mix.
But Romney has panned clean energy jobs and the clean energy industry before.
We all like wind and solar, but you can't drive a car with a windmill on it.
and his stated policies and white paper call for eliminating federal investment in clean energy, including the crucial wind energy production tax credit that's set to expire at the end of this year. And Romney keeps billions in taxpayer subsidies for oil. And then there was Romney's bogus accusations on the decline of coal in the U.S. Power companies are driving that by switching to cheaper, more profitable natural gas. That's the free market at work. Not at the debate was Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein.
The one candidate who had a problem mentioning the word climate.
Climate is in meltdown.
Yes, she has a true progressive agenda on climate change and clean energy, and she was actually arrested outside the debate forum for trying to get in.
How dare her? A presidential candidate on 85% of the country's ballots trying to participate in the presidential debate?
I know, it's crazy. Also not at the debate, climate change. I think MSNBC's Chris Hayes said it best.
Having an energy conversation without talking about climate is like talking about smoking and not talking about cancer. You can't talk about it unless you talk about what the stakes are for the climate. Who is the more pro-coal candidate is talking about who is going to most hastily speed our headlong flight of disaster.
Poll after poll shows that Americans are finally grasping the connection between global warming and extreme weather events, and that climate change is a winning campaign wedge issue. Yet, they ignore it.
For more on our headlong flight of disaster, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider purchasing a copy of Greg Palast's Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, along with his Election Files DVD. That's our new premium at bradblog.com, and we rely on you, not corporations or foundations, to stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Ooh, ooh, I'm missing you. Tell me why the road turns. Ooh, ooh, I'm missing you.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeed, 13 minutes past the hour. We'll begin the conversation part of Conversation Radio right now. And let me just get this faded here. Someday we'll have, like, producers, fact checkers, and call screeners. And no, we won't. Yeah, it's pretty much going to be this way forever. But that's okay. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Bob.
Hey, Juanita. Well, thank you for
being... Are you better?
Well, yeah, but no, you know.
You're hanging in, huh?
I feel better, but the problem is not resolved, and we're trying to figure out how in God's name we're ever going to resolve it.
Yeah.
So,
well, what was you going to say to me? Thank you for something?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for being so patient.
Oh, okay. You're welcome. Well, I didn't know I was so patient.
No, I just no. I mean, you've been blinking for a while, and I appreciate you.
Oh well, yeah. I remember when you were telling a while back about the sushi.
Yeah, I've told that story before.
Did you go to school about it?
Oh, we did. We did, and we got a line of crap.
That's what it did.
You know, she was just concerned that it might not be safe.
Oh yeah, sure.
Right, because I'm gonna. Hey, kid, here's your lunch. It's unsafe. Enjoy it.
Yeah. Do you remember that parody that I wrote about that?
Oh, yes. If you knew sushi like I know sushi. Yeah, absolutely. I remember when you sang it.
Do you still have that? Because I think I lost my copy.
Somewhere way back, a million miles back in my files, I probably do. I don't throw much away.
I probably do, too, but I don't...
My Gmail account's getting expensive because I keep having to buy more storage.
Yeah. Well, maybe mine will turn up.
Well, if I dig back, maybe I can find it. It's,
yeah. Well, if you do, I appreciate you send me a copy of it.
Well, I'll try. I will really try.
Okay.
I got a couple of other search projects out there to complete, too.
Anyway, I was calling about a few things, and some of it I've forgotten what I was calling about, but I did see Mrs. What's her name today?
Ms. Romney on the... you're putting your view correspondent hat on. Good.
Well, I do sometimes. It's so shallow most of the time. You know, you think they're going to really get into something, and, of course, bless her heart, Elizabeth was really been out of shape today about this. She's so excited about Romney getting up in points and about this president is just not doing anything for our country. But anyway.
You do that far too well.
Anyways, first of all, Barbara says something to her about him saying that they were sharp-tongued.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, no, he said that you were sharp and young. Of course, you know,
isn't that funny?
Yeah.
She lies so cute.
She's very slick.
Yeah.
And anyway, she had one of her sons in the audience, but anyway, they...
Was it the one that said he wanted to go down and punch the president?
No, but they asked her about that, and he spoke. She said, well, I think he can tell you better than I can. You know, that she can't answer for somebody else.
Well, you people don't need an answer for that.
Anyway, he said, well, you know, he was just kidding. He didn't really mean it. Said, the president wouldn't have anything to worry about me. Said, trust me. Said, he's not that strong.
Yeah, in other words, he's another cowardly Republican, right?
But we'll be asking him about why they had none of them gone into service. And
that had to be a dandy.
Well, it was done well done. She said that her understanding was that the church didn't approve of them being in service, and she said, oh no, that's not right. But she said they did their missionary work, and she said, you know, they go off as young boys and they come back as men. They've gone like 2.5 years.
Yeah,
and she said, and one of my sons said he feels like he's serving our country. He's a doctor.
Are there any bullets flying around him?
He's helping the wounded soldiers.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so, but anyway.
For a price, of course.
Well, you know what Romney said about them, about their service. Their service to the country is helping him in his election. That's their service to the country.
Right, because we lumping proletariat out here, as Mrs. Ann Real Marriage Romney noted, we don't understand how privileged we are to have Bishop Willard willing to run for the presidency.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's their turn.
We owe them, Juanita,
yes,
don't
that's
we?
Why, right, that's what she said. She said, it's our turn. I don't know whose turn.
I didn't know the presidency was turn-based.
I didn't either. But did you hear about today about he's carefully wording it and asking people who run companies to ask their employees to vote for him?
In fact, I've got
in their best interest.
I've got the audio right here.
In their best interest.
Yeah.
Now, listen, isn't that what they always accuse of the unions of doing?
Right, but a union can't really do that.
They don't. I know a lot of people who went against the union.
Sure.
A lot of them.
But no, if there was an actually enterprising prosecutor out there somewhere, what that is, Juanita, is voter suppression. That is voter intimidation. That is a crime. And to the
careful how he words it.
Yeah, but to the extent that he worded it at all, Willard should be, that tape should be presented to a grand jury, and Willard should be subjected to an indictment for voter intimidation.
Yeah, he should
And understand, for criminal conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
because that was a conspiracy among him and the job creators to intimidate voters into voting for him.
Right.
And, you know, the Koch brothers have sent out memos. That sick guy with the mega mansion down in Florida, the timeshare guy, he tried to intimidate his workers.
You talking about the one that threatened to shut down his business?
Yeah.
Oh, he's from Florida?
The one who said business has never been better, but I can't promise you it's going to be that good if we have a second term of Obama.
And you said he's from Florida?
Oh, yeah.
That's hard to believe, Bob.
Yeah. You're awful. You're just awful when you're sarcastic, Juanita.
I know, but it helps sometimes. I get to thinking, oh my God, here we've got this governor down here.
Oh, I'll be surprised if Pat Buchanan doesn't wind up coming in second in the Florida primary, you know, behind Bishop Willard or something.
Who?
Pat Buchanan.
Oh yeah.
Even though he's not running.
Yeah. Did you see that thing they had in Onion about our new voting system?
Oh my God, I did see that.
You did?
Yeah, with the 12,000 levers and.
Right. They said if you put a certain button, you could vote straight at Republica without a problem.
Right. I love that.
There was so much went on back then, Bob. You know, we were beset on every side. Now we've got a new ad down here. I don't think you probably get it because it's part of that Daniel Webster.
Mm-hmm.
It's got our real cute, I think she's the DA. She's either the DA or Secretary of State. I forget which. She's real cute blonde. Anyway, and she's very right-wing. And she's coming out. And then guess who's next?
Who?
In support. Jeb.
Well, of course.
His little bubble head sticks up there, and he's got his little smile on his face. And then Adam Putnam. And then you get Jeb Bush back, and he's, and these are our kind of people. These are people like we are. Well, okay. That's not
right.
Me.
Yeah.
I'm not included.
No, I don't think you're on that list, Juanita.
But he is so trying, Eddie. Jeb.
Mm. Well,
all of a sudden we get these ads.
Well, there was no all of a sudden in the creation or the financing of them.
No. But you know that during the 2000 election, I watched all of that stuff. But anyway, he had all the lawyers in Florida, all the best lawyers in Florida lined up before, you know, the election. Or if any problems arose, that they would be available to handle everything for them, you know, which they did. I don't know if that's anything that anybody knows about, but few of us down here. But that's just one thing.
It's got to be like a trip to the circus down there, Juanita.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to turn the television on.
Well, no.
Of course, we can't open our mailbox without getting some flyer telling us who loves coal more.
Yeah,
we're getting right-wing robocalls and.
Yeah, they really got that.
I feel like just putting a message on the answering machine that says, "Hello, we'll answer the phone again on November the 7th. Goodbye."
I'm getting all kind of crazy calls.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
Not just about elections, but all kind of con games. I've got one that's saying the sheriff wants us to get these things in our yard to deter crooks. Well, these crooks around here, you don't deter them by a little sign. And this some of the stuff they've got now, I never heard of before. They're just hatching up stuff to try to rip you off. one way or the other.
But that's what we're there for, Juanita.
Yeah.
We exist to enrich our betters.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Just like you were talking about earlier about the jobs. They know that the only way they can bring those jobs back is if they've got us ground down to where, even though we'll accept anything, you know, just to have something to live, like you were talking about the coal miners. You think your grandfather was paid in tokens, or
yeah,
script, yeah.
Yeah.
And that song of 16 tons is so true.
Yeah, that's how you wound up owing your soul to the company store, because you were paying
the
script.
That's what they do now to these people that they bring, a lot of them that they bring in to work over here, at least here in Florida, from years and years ago, you know, not just now, to do migrant work,
mm-hmm.
to pick the fruit and the vegetables and stuff. And they get a lot of them in these camps, and they're virtual prisoners. And they'll get somebody and these are people like, you know, that witch we had here. Well, I don't want to insult witches.
Right, I understand.
But
that nasty, nasty, vile, hateful woman. Yeah.
That was her face that we had, our Secretary of State or whatever.
Catherine Harris.
Yeah, Catherine Harris. Yeah. I don't hear about her anymore. But see, she comes from that family where they had a lot of migrant workers.
Mm.
But, you know, the agriculture businesses down here is loaded with...
yeah,
you know.
I know some activists who work among the migrant farm worker culture, and they sat and told me stories, and I just sat with my head in my hands to listen.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It really is heartbreaking. But it's been going on. Nobody even thinks anything about it hardly.
No.
When, years ago, I worked for Department of Agriculture. It was a program that Johnson had started, and was working with migrants, basically. And that was before we had food stamps. We had what we call commodities, which a lot of the stuff was great, including, you know, like the cheese was great.
Was it Kate that was telling me that the cheese has even been degraded now?
It might have been, I don't know, but
back in the day, that cheese was magnificent.
Oh yeah,
made the best pan of macaroni and cheese. Oh,
but they had like a lot of powdered milk and powdered eggs, and they had some beans that you had to follow the recipe, or you were. Exactly, or you were never going to see those beans get soft. Oh, I've never seen anything like it. But what we were supposed to do was teach people, you know, how to use all those things, because a lot of people didn't know how.
I've never heard of a bean you can screw up.
They were little teeny weeny ones, and I don't know what they were, but they were unbelievable. Now, if you cooked them exactly according to directions, they would cook. But unbelievable.
What was a lentil or something? Or
I don't remember what kind, but they were these that they were giving them out to. You would get so much for each person. I was so glad when they started food stamps instead of that.
I do miss the cheese.
But anyway, But
well,
you
now,
know
now
they,
you got me all curious, because I never heard about the impossible to cook beans.
I wish I could find out. It's been so many years
Well,
ago.
Somebody out there knows.
It's been so many years ago, but this was in Florida. Florida had.
Well, what color were they?
They were like brown, little teeny brown things.
Sounds like.
Can you imagine shelling those?
Well, it sounds like a lentil, and it does. I mean, because you can mess
yeah,
up.
Know.
You can mess up a lentil.
I don't know. It makes me want to look online and see if I can find it out. But that was just. Now you could really make good eggs out of the
powdered eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we develop a lot of recipes and stuff like that, you know. But then we had some cheaters, people that cheated on it, and then we were all in trouble.
No.
You know, like people, they would make up family names. You had to go and to the family.
Well, right. No, you can't trust those poor folks. They'll try to get extra food, you know.
Well, these were the workers.
Yeah. But they'll try to eat more than they're allowed to.
They were the coworkers, you know. They were that. This went on for a couple of years before they caught. So they made up these names, these family names, and they just sitting at home making their money.
Well, my, you know, we would get an occasional block of that commodity cheese because somebody that my dad worked with
that's how I got some of that stuff.
Would you want some of this? Darn right, hand it here, some of it. Give me all you got. Oh, we don't like it. Well, that's because you're an idiot. Give it here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course, you know, that's like I said, that's an old running gag about why you can't take a group picture of hillbillies.
Why is that?
Because every time the photographer says cheese, we form a single line.
That's pretty good. Oh, Bob, I needed to laugh.
Well, if we can't, you know, what's the alternative?
Yeah. Well, but one thing I was just talking about, this is just a little bit, about food. You were talking about food.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to see whatever you saw on the YouTube.
Don't.
Pressing the food.
Don't. You'll be a vegan by tomorrow sunrise.
Yeah. But I had, my daddy was told about some of the jobs he had back during the Depression. And he had one job where they had to work. Now, can you imagine how the food is bad enough what they do now, but this was no inspection. He had a job canning lamb.
And I never knew there was canned lamb.
And it was outside, and he said the gnats were just flying everywhere. And anyway, he said that, well, I don't know if I can say this like him, but he was saying it would be so funny because he didn't have any underwear, and his pants, he had, like, they had little holes in them, and he said the gnats would go in and out the window. And,
Lord.
Anyway, can you imagine? And he said the lamb would have some of the skin and, hair on it, you know, whatever.
Now, I do remind you, Juanita, that it is dinner time for a lot of or lunch or breakfast.
Well, this was in the Depression back.
I understand.
Way yonder, but I'm saying this is what it'll come to, only worse than this. And he said a lot of people just leave it on. You know, they were there, they needed the money, and you know his conscience wouldn't let him do that. You know, he'd take it off. But he said the gnats were just horrible. Why in the world would they do something like that outside? But.
Well, you don't want them inside.
I don't know.
That's where the decent people are.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But see, they don't care. They don't care to make the money. They don't care. They don't care how they do it. They don't care how. You know, here in Florida, we've got that, people dying from those shots.
Oh, right. Yeah. The fungal infected.
Guess what our governor did?
What?
He gave out a phone number for people to call, and it was porno number.
Huh. Well, we actually got a mailer here from one of the hospitals in the region saying, our hospital has never used any of that stuff. Our pain clinic doesn't use that stuff. Don't worry. Quit calling us.
Well, we haven't got nothing, except all I know is what I see on TV or read on the Internet, But anyway, I thought I liked the debate, but I know there was a lot of things that needed to be said, but...
Well, I'm just glad that one Romney didn't come down and beat up our president.
Yeah, right. Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be fun? You'd see what,
The thing is, Juanita, that bears out another one of the similarities between Romneys and Bushes. Because remember how we learned that the young George W. Bush or younger George W. Bush just seethed in impotent fury to see his sainted daddy so abused by that Clinton. You know, they've got these privileged people have this obnoxious streak of self entitlement that nobody you know. No, you can't call my daddy a liar when he's lying.
But my daddy can call you a liar. What about his little girls, Obama's little girls? I mean, they don't think about it. Hey, I think you're totally right. I totally agree. If you could have seen her on there, and I'm sure they'll have it on the Internet, Mrs. Romney.
Oh, I saw some pictures earlier. And it,
I just wish
one of those ladies there on The View would have asked her about her real marriage and just whose marriage she meant to denigrate when she said that at the convention. But, yeah,
she said what?
At the convention, when Ann Romney said, "My husband and I have a real marriage."
Okay.
Whose marriage was she implying wasn't real?
I wonder who.
But that would have been a good one for Whoopi to ask, but sadly,
did pretty good today.
Well, I don't have Whoopi on the speed dial, so I couldn't get that one in. You have yourself a wonderful evening. It's awful good to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you too.
You take care now.
All right. All right. Get well.
I'm trying.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Our View correspondent from Central Florida. That is the inimitable Juanita. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, hey, it's John in North Kakalaki. How are you?
Good, John. Good. You?
I'm doing great. Sorry you caught me. I was reading something else. Exciting radiocarbon news. Anyway.
Oh, fun.
Listen, I've never...
The Secret Life of Isotopes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Secret Lives of Isotopes. Ways to calibrate dates when we don't have tree ring datings. Anyway, I'll stop before I make more folks tune out.
No, we love this stuff.
Yeah, no, definitely. Listen, I wanted to say I've been listening for a while, and I've never heard that story about your boy and the sushi. That was heartbreaking to me. Man, I can't believe that.
I was furious. Just tears of rage. I mean, it was I was not a well man. Agnes was like grabbing me by the shirt sleeve as I was headed out the door. No, dear, no, we don't have the bail money, dear. You know that.
It's a formative time in a kid's life. It's when tastes are made, you know, and authorities, you know, saying that kind of thing to them. That's rough. And plus, it's something you made, and yeah, it was terrible in every possible sense. Listen, what I wanted to say, something you mentioned the other night about the news from the talk radio industry meeting that you were reading about how the future of radio is not over-the-air broadcasting, it's internet broadcasting. And that's kind of been working in my head, and I've kind of got this maybe sort of strange half-formed idea that might be a really bad thing.
I think it probably is, but tell me why.
Well, maybe we're going to the same place. Kind of basically two words: Radio Rwanda, and that's Sandra's thrown that idea out to the audience talking about Fox News, but that's a real thing that she's talking about. I don't need to tell our audience that, obviously, but. I think we've seen a really bad example in recent history of what happens when sort of uncontrolled, unregulated broadcasting goes out and people can basically say whatever they want. You know, over-the-air broadcasting run by corporations, regulated by, you know, the FCC and all that stuff, there's certainly problems with the model, but corporations that run the big broadcasters are nothing if not cautious, nothing if not conservative. And when you have people say very dangerous, potentially inflammatory things, there are mechanisms in place to discipline them, and there is a sort of behavioral change about big broadcasters like the Fat Man, who we will not name, to stop them from saying overtly inflammatory, dangerous things like we saw in the Rwanda case. And I guess my concern, and it's sort of half-formed, is that if we move to the Internet for all broadcasting, you know, for all sort of talk broadcasting, basically it's not all going to sound like you do. It's not going to be smart and rational and coming from a good place. Most of it's going to be coming from a very bad place and freed from any sort of change and chains and fetters or whatever. I think there's a great potential for some really dangerous, insightful stuff out there.
Yeah, in INCITE as opposed to SIGHT, right?
Yes, insightful, exactly right. Yeah.
Well, there are a number of problems inherent in the death of terrestrial broadcasting that have been apparent for quite some time. I happen, John, to have been familiar with some processes in the attempt to see what it would take to acquire a broadcast license, you know, in this area.
Uh-huh.
You can't get one. Because every time a license, a little spectrum of the available licensing bandwidth comes up, it gets snapped up by some Holy Joe's herpetological sanctuary, and you get the idea. I mean, and ultimately that's what's going to happen to the AM band.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be either, well, if you listen, for instance, in a major metropolitan area, you're going to hear one of three things. Right-wing radio, Jesus talk, or Spanish language.
Yeah.
And now in D.C., at least on one channel, it has expanded into Mandarin.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. I spent about probably 72 miles listening to what sounded very much like the same formatting as Rosetta Stone of Mandarin. Teaching Mandarin speakers how to teach how to speak English.
Wow. Okay.
And I was I had the same response, but then there's a wild variety of Spanish language stuff on the AM dial in metropolitan areas, and the rest of it is either right wing hate or Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So the AM band has already become a sort of electronic ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
Now what you're seeing is a transference of right-wing hate into the FM band. And there's some Spanish language music stations, but right-wing hate talk is going onto the FM band, and because most of these stations are owned by some corporation that owns, you know, 150 licenses, We may be, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm suggesting that we may be on a different place on the timeline of your concern than where maybe you think we are.
Okay.
We're already past where maybe you were saying, because that message lockdown is already present, because it's not like there's a wide variety of Jesus radio. It's not like there's an Episcopalian channel and a Presbyterian channel, and then there's the Methodist. No, it's either rosary in one hand, chicken in the other, Roman Catholic radio, or hardcore fundamentalist evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's disturbing.
Well, it is, but I guess what I'm saying is that now, but even AM and FM are both governed by you know, rules of what you can and can't say or put your license at risk and that sort of thing, and also sort of market forces. The corporations that own the stations, the bands that the talkers talk on, have some sense of what their audience wants and what is sort of beyond the pale of what people can say. But if it all is moving to unregulated internet stuff, it seems like there's a great potential for the kind of excess that we see when people don't have any rules that they operate under.
I think so, but let's remember that as far as terrestrial radio is concerned, the complaint that was being, or not the complaint, but the sort of warning that was being given by that guy at that Talkers Magazine conference was not, was more along the lines of, and I don't think he could say it outright. I mean, this guy was the guy who founded Westwood One, and they do baseball games and football, and I mean, they do all kinds of different programming. They bought, you remember the old Mutual broadcasting system? You know, they bought Mutual, I think. But his complaint was that in the niche where right-wing hate exists, and of course he couldn't call it that, it has become difficult for the plaid jacket-wearing Herb Tarlicks of the world to go out and sell advertising on it. The problem is that that has translated across to an already strapped, the already strapped attempts to sell advertising on whatever progressive radio there may be, because what we're learning is that advertisers are just generally running away from controversy. You know, you talk about you know, the regulation that exists in terrestrial radio. Frankly, there's really not that much. Because when you get right down to it, the Hannitys, the Limbaughs, the Alex Jones, you know, can sit there and spew any manner of lies and any manner of violent filth. Glenn Beck nearly got people murdered at the Tides Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as he didn't say shit, literally the word, while he was while he was advocating that, he was okay.
Right.
Because, you know, he won't be held responsible for the actions of a crazy loner.
But there are market forces, though. Like, don't you think that to some degree he self-censors because he knows that if there's a line that if he crosses, then the people who sign his paychecks will stop signing the paycheck.
Right, and it's the constant search for, because they always have to one-up each other, there is a constant search on for where that line is, and they only find it by going over it. Rush Limbaugh, for instance, found it by inventing the Sandra Fluck controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And
but go on.
Well, I was going to say, I was reading a Daily Coast diary today where there was some rather interesting news pointed out. He has slipped. There's a pretty broad gulf between number two and number one now, and he's the number two hate radio talker in America now.
Behind who?
That part I don't know.
Oh.
I'm guessing Hannity.
Yeah. Well, he's so cute. I mean, you know, even though it's radio.
Well, he's a life support system for a haircut.
Oh, sure.
I also understand what you're saying about internet radio. Internet radio is not regulated. One of these days it will be. I guarantee it. As sure as God made little green apples, John, somebody's going to try to extend FCC regulation to the internet. You know, one of the things that has always bothered me about internet radio is that it has an element of elitism in it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like for anybody who wants to hear this program to be able to hear this program simply by turning on something that brings in an over-the-air signal.
Yeah.
Because, that's my sense of democracy at work.
Sure.
But this program cannot reach anyone who does not have an internet connection,
mm-hmm.
which means that you are already paying for the privilege of participating in whatever may or may not be free speech.
Yeah,
and that's disturbing. It's disturbing that we're going to leave the people's airwaves to the tender mercies. Well, we already have of a teeny tiny little handful of massive transnational corporations who will dictate what it is we need to see, what it is we need to hear, and what it is we need to think. That's why, I don't get my news from television. I don't, as much as I love, for instance, Rachel Maddow, as much respect as I have for Chris Hayes, they operate within a gatekeeping framework that is made of the hardest steel. And so, everything is compromised. I've got this one clip here. I haven't played it. It's kind of a long clip of Carol Costello.
Yeah. Oh, at CNN?
At CNN. Taking down the American Family Association's Brian Fisher.
Oh, she must have ate her Wheaties that morning.
Oh, she, and then she ate him for lunch.
Wow. Okay.
And I can't imagine what kind of pushback they're getting, because you don't do that. Maybe she got away with it because he was an easy target, because he's just slightly to the left of Westboro Baptist.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess my point is that I feel secure in, you know, you and the folks who call in, you know, our ability to sort of run with scissors, you know, in this unregulated internet marketplace. But I'm afraid of what happens if there is a massive movement of, you know, or increase in right-wing talk moving through the internet, because I see that in a case like that, with a funding model like we have, or Sam Cedar does or something, it seems like there's a potential for a big megaphone and no fetters whatsoever.
Right. Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons that net neutrality is so important. If the day comes when internet service providers are able to determine who moves at what speed, I lose, Malloy loses, Cedar loses, Rick Smith loses, you know, we lose. On the other hand, to a certain extent, some of those things that you fear already exist. I mentioned Brian Fisher. That guy, yes, he's on terrestrial radio, but he's also on the internet. They have figured this thing out. There is all kinds of right-wing radio out there, all of which are so well funded that they could buy and sell us before breakfast. And our only defense is to build audience while we can.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, as good at product placement as I am, and you know, name dropping products and stuff like that, I think I would be the equal of that old horse molester Paul Harvey. But I don't think anybody's ever going to ask me to do it. Especially because we don't have the infrastructure to get anybody to go out there and do the asking for the asking. If we wanted to be, if we wanted to be commercial, you know, one of these days, it's one of my dreams, John. You just kind of opened this door, and I don't want to just sit here and talk your ear off. But I'd like to see a summit of people who do a lot of internet broadcasting. You know, I'd like to sit down at the same table. You know, me, Rick Smith, Malloy, Cedar, some of the others. And start talking about, for instance, how we could build a consortium enough to make a living for, I mean, if this was the model we wanted to work by, enough to make a living for a marketing person who could go out and get ethical ads placed on all of our shows. Because one show by itself is not going to, possibly it'll reach enough, but it's the power of volume buying that makes it worthwhile. That's why even on so-called progressive radio, you will hear ads, you know, for Buy Gold Now and vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls and drop them on Swedish mattresses, because that is the stuff that is sold to talk radio listeners, be they left or right. I personally don't think it's as effective with progressive listeners, simply because we're not dumb enough to buy them.
No, we're not stupid enough to buy high and sell low. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Maybe there are those among the progressive radio listenership who will actually buy a product that will miraculously give them an erection with hair on it. I mean, I always listen to those ads on right-wing radio, and I think, well, I know why they're advertising to these people. They're dumb enough to buy them.
Yeah. Huh.
So, but you've raised a whole bunch of different stuff, John, that really needs to be thought out. And it needs to be thought out on a level of on the serious level of sustainability. And it needs to be addressed before we get buried.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, can you imagine? He's all over the place. He's got a great haircut. You know, Brian Fisher. This guy's got to have enough money to buy God, and he does it simply from hustling hate.
It is really shocking. I sent you a long thing a while back about, you know, I tuned into some of that, and it's amazing how sort of integrated that whole hustle is, you know, from the guest or the host to the callers to the advertising. But yeah, no, you're right. And I tell you, if there was able to be a summit like the one you described, that would be a hell of a thing. It would be really something to see, and you definitely I want to say sort of put my fears to rest, but I don't think you really did that. So I guess
I don't know that it was a fear that could be put to rest, John.
Yeah.
I need to dig. I read that when you sent it in, and just sat there thinking, oh my God, he's been washed in the blood. Because you had opportunity to drive around and just hear the full filthy panoply of right-wing hate, right-wing religious hate, right?
Oh, definitely. It didn't get through my shell, though, so no worries.
Oh, no, the shields weren't breached or anything, but
we're still full force.
Right, you knew you'd been hit.
Yeah, I definitely felt it. I'm going to let you go. Listen, really quickly, just huge thanks to the folks who put up the challenge last night and everybody who was able to contribute, and just really, really glad to hear how that worked out. So I'll get out of your way here, but it's good talking to you, Bob.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, John, and continuing good luck in your endeavors.
Thanks very much.
All right. Bye now. Bye-bye. Our buddy Dr. John, off in North Kakalaki. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Jimmy Dean.
Pardon?
Jimmy Dean, Bob.
No, Jimmy Dean. Yeah.
Jimmy Dean pork sausage.
Pure pork sausage.
I came back because there's these food Nazis out there in California, Bob. These food Nazis, Bob.
Oh, terrible food Nazis. Awful.
Proposition 37. They're trying to go for my business, Bob. I'm going to bring back Big John, Bob. Big John.
Yeah, Big Bad John.
Big Bad John. Every morning at the line, you can see him arrive. He's at 6'6", the weight 245. Got broad the shoulder, narrow at the hip. Everybody knew you didn't give no lift to Big John. Big John. Big John. Big Bad John. Yeah, Bob, they're fighting us pretty hard here.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Where is this notion that it's going to cost $400 a year simply to have no GMO ingredients printed on the label, or some percentage if there are?
They're trying to say that what you're going to have to do at all these supermarkets and all these stores that sell products, you have to do exactly what you do with organic products. You're going to have to kind of separate them out on the shelves and have a whole new category of food, which is the GMO food. They're trying to make that case. And it's going to cause a whole disruption in the whole presentation of the food. It's a joke. Because as you saw with the piece I sent you, it's only ink. And that's what I keep telling people. Man, it's only ink. It's just ink on a label. You just have to say it's GMO. It's only ink, man. It's going to have no effect. And according to the European Commissioner Byrne, I think on that sheet I times that when they did food labeling in Europe with the EU countries, there was no change in cost. Matter of fact, when I confronted some dude when I was down in Half Moon Bay, he goes, "Where's the economist here? I gotta talk to an economist." And I go, "What's the matter?" He goes, "This is gonna cost, you know, $400 for $400 million. You don't understand, this is gonna cost us money." And I'm there, what changes food prices is oil prices. Man, this doesn't have any effect. All it is ink on a label, man. Of course, you got all bent out of shape with me, and we went at it, man. We were mixing it up pretty good. Unreal.
Well, what I suspect that they're really whining about is their costs, Andy.
Exactly what I tell you. It's their margin. They know they have to change the ingredients. They're no longer going to sell the GMO ingredient in the bottle. And they know that because that's what happened in Europe and Japan. People will not buy the GMO. Coke is going to have to take aspartame out of Diet Coke because that's a GMO. And you know they don't want to do that because any substitute is going to cost them more. And like this fool that want to talk to an economist, I'm no economist, but I do have some advanced degrees. Food companies are price takers. They're price takers. They cannot change their prices. They're going to have to keep their prices at the supermarket retail the same. Their ingredients are going to change, and they're going to have to use better ingredients than non-GMO, because GMO ingredients are a lot cheaper. That's why they use them.
Hey, Andy, can I interrupt for just a second? I just got an email in from Isaac. He asks if you're on a Bluetooth, because he says he's having a hard time hearing you.
Yeah, I am.
Is there any way you can go to the regular handset?
Last time I tried to do that, I lost you. So, if I do it,
it's a different process with every phone, so I understand completely. Well, let me just ask you this. Where, you know, you said $1 million a day is being spent to defeat this.
I've seen from like 32 to 37 million, and they estimate it could go as high as 50 million.
Jesus.
It's over. And we've only got like 4 or 5 million. You know?
But the question I have is, spending that kind of money, how does that not impact food prices?
Absolutely. It's the cost of them doing business to feed us like that. That's a lot of money.
And ultimately, as I have said, I'm sure there's people out there that have better advice than anything I would either know or suggest, and I don't do legal advice in the first place. But I do have real concerns about the Roberts Court, Andy, and how they will receive this. Because, I mean, you know that if this thing is passed, it will be taken on up. It'll go to the Supreme Court of the state of California, and from there it will wing its way to Capitol Hill and be addressed, and I fear stricken by this gang of ugly little fascists as somehow violative. I think they would probably hang their hats either on interstate commerce, or hang their hats on what's the phrase I'm trying to think of here? Preemption. That the state cannot impose a heavier burden than the federal government has.
I agree. There's no question they're not going to give up. They're willing to spend this kind of money.
But maybe in doing that, do you think that would wake people up to the degree to which we are being manipulated by big food or fascist food or whatever we care to call it?
Well, just
when I was this weekend at this pumpkin festival that they had, which is pretty cool, it's a really beautiful place right off the Pacific Ocean is where I was, and there's some really nice-sized farms out there. And it was a large amount of people. There was actually a lot of people that were from out of state that were there. Matter of fact, I remember talking to a woman from Arkansas, and I talked to somebody from Texas, and they all mentioned, this is great that you guys are doing this. We wish we could do that, you know, where we are. We're totally behind you.
And I remember I talked to a guy from Pennsylvania as well. I spent like 4 or 5 hours there, man. I was just going through the crowd handing out flyers, and I did speak to a lot of people, and yeah, people are really behind this. They'd love to see us win here because they know this would be a big win. It'll get a lot of airtime, and you know it's a real thorn in the rear end of Monsanto and these food companies. They know this could be the beginning of the end for them. So they're willing to spend the big dollars to, you know, nip this in the bud right away. No question.
Yeah, because Alabama is never going to try to enact something like this, and neither is Kansas or Texas.
Right.
And where the economies of scale are concerned, Alabama doesn't count, but where economies of scale are concerned in this country, one of two states obtains. California and Texas. It's just like school textbooks. And so if California can do this, then maybe, you know, then maybe it sweeps the nation. But shoot, I remember writing to my congressman years ago when I heard about the downer cattle being included in school lunch meat, whether it be chili or vegetable beef soup or the pepperoni that's in the sausage and the phony bologna sausage crappy pizza that they serve. And I said, you know, would it be so hard to get a little labeling done? And of course I got the thank you, don't ever write me again letter back. But it's very troubling, and it's a step like this is very important. And ultimately if we look down the road, and I don't necessarily want to open this can of worms, Andy, but if we look down the road to where the United States of America may be headed, you know, having that kind of labeling would be something that one of the Balkanized states of the U.S. would engage in. You know, a nation made up of, say, Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, you know, you get the idea.
Well, they pretty much know if they have to do it in California, we're a big state, we're the biggest state by population, is that they're probably going to have to do it through the whole country just because it's not worth it changing the label someplace else if you're going to have to do it for California.
Well, and there will also be a California database that people can access and say, I don't want to buy that because it's got that in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a genie that they're desperate to keep in the bottle.
Right. If you know Nature's Path, which is actually supporting us with money, Eden Foods, also on our site, they already do that labeling. They already indicate that there's no GMOs in their foods.
Well, wasn't there a big kerfuffle a year or two back about the labeling regarding bovine growth hormone, where the federal government, the milk industry, the Got Milk people, you know, they're so wholesome, got vicious. And said, you know, we can't tolerate this. And so it was the idea of a law that would have required the labeling of milk products that contained RGBH, recombinant bovine growth hormone, was struck down or stopped.
Wasn't that in Vermont? Maybe they did that, or they tried.
It seems like, yeah, maybe that was Vermont. Yeah.
Vermont also tried to do this food labeling as well, and it got shut down there. Lawsuits, I think. But they're one of the states. My understanding, this has been tried 18 times across the country, mainly by state legislatures, to have the labeling, and it's been shot down every time. Oregon was shot down in a referendum. They had a referendum, and it lost just slightly.
It's interesting. Ron and Raleigh wrote this question in. He said, how far are we from Soylent Green? We can't be labeling that reprocessed human flesh. It could cause a drop in consumer confidence and share price. The average shareholder would take a dump in your food if they thought it would increase their share price one penny. And that's the truth. That's the truth of corporate America.
And too many people, economics, they think too much of the economic side, not the health side and the well-being. I keep bringing up to people, hey, diabetes is up 80% in 10 years in this country. 80%.
I just raised my hand, Andy. You know, it's not like I've lived my life eating, nothing but sugar. I did not deliberately burn up my body's ability to produce insulin. And so far, I'm okay because all I have to do is take medicine.
Well, you know, I'm with you, man. I'm in the same boat as you. And autism is way up. What else? The allergies are way up. And there's something going on. There's something. And what is it? The New York Times on September 21st, reversing the trend on lifespan. We're now 41st for women.
Yeah, and that was September 21st, but I remember the story a year or two ago. We were talking about because traditionally it was the advances in women's life expectancy that had been sort of the benchmark, and it was a year or two ago, and it was from, I think, our folks at Facing South that had that story that detailed the decrease in life expectancy among women in the Southeast, which, of course, includes Appalachia.
Right.
And when you start talking about decreases in life expectancy, that's when the little lights go on around your head and the thought bubble appears and you realize, Jesus Christ, they're killing us. They really are killing us.
Right. And in that article, that women without high school diplomas have shaved 5 years off their lifespan in 18 years, from 1990 to 2008. Women without high school diplomas, white women, have lost 5 years off their lifespan. It's a fact.
Right, and I mean, always, we can look all the way around the world, Andy, and we realize, for instance, in many ways you can argue that the key to the entire survival of the species and the planet is, despite binders, how women do. In every nation where you give women reproductive choice, family size goes down, overpopulation begins to reverse, and civilization advances. Life expectancy advances. So I'm not surprised to see a backtrend among non-high school diploma women, because that means that they're likely to be carrying more children, trying to care for more children, therefore splitting the nutritional pie, and naturally, mama is always going to do worse than the babies. This is not rocket science.
Right, 43% of those women have no health care.
Yeah.
No health care. So you know what that says, see? I mean, you talk about the cost just in the worry about something does happen to you.
Yeah, and again, I'm not trying to overly personalize or create some sort of the sympathy vortex or anything. But even where I'm concerned, I'm a member of the uninsured. I'm not talking about this as some academic debate. This is my reality. I've got a gallbladder in me that can't come out. Even if I had insurance, my doc says as of yesterday he doesn't want to take it out until he's had me seen by a cardiologist because he's disturbed about some symptoms that I've described to him, but I can't see the cardiologist either. I mean, Andy, I'll tell you squarely, I feel like the Republican Party and Willard Romney and all of the purpose of healthcare companies is to provide profit instead of healthcare, all of these people have put a price on my head. And they put a price on 45,000 Americans' heads who are going to die every godforsaken year that we don't have universal, single-payer health care access. And I'm sorry, I'm not yelling at you. But, I mean, that's a damn scary thing to confront, whether it be 3 o'clock in the morning sitting bolt upright with flop sweats or behind a microphone at 15 minutes past 8 p.m. on a Thursday.
I'm with you, man. I'm completely with you. You know, I mentioned that email to you that even Vermont, where they're working on that single payer, that can't go into effect until 2017 because of the way the Affordable Care Act was written.
Yeah, and in fact, Jeremy wrote in to make that point as well.
Yeah. So even that, they tried to even cover. They'll give more time so they can maybe knock that out. But this is, it's an assault. You know, it's a complete assault, Bob. It's a complete attack on the working class in this country. It's a complete war. People have to understand. You're plutocrats. You're with war with the top 1%. And like you said, they almost have a gun to our head with this health care thing. It's awful.
And I've got to collect my wits until I can put some of this in writing. Like I said, I don't know where it's ever going to get published. But I've got to put it. I can't just sit here and babble behind the microphone about it. I've got to put it in writing, and just put it out there for consideration. Because this is real. I mean, and it's not like it was less real when I had some kind of poor folks coverage, but it is brutally real to me now, frighteningly, terrifyingly real.
Right. You have to excuse me, too. I can see my phone's running out of gas.
All right. Well, listen, we will talk again soon. I really appreciate everything you brought along this evening, and, of course, I always do. And let me extend to you my personal thanks for hooking me up with Peter B. Collins for that wonderful conversation I had with him this past Monday.
I'm glad that worked out. Okay. Just real quick, too. You had a caller the other day, John from Portland. And he mentioned that he was getting job interviews.
Oh, Paul, it was an email, yeah.
He should be happy. If you're getting interviews, man, you're going to get a job. I mean, just hang in there. Just keep it up. Keep the pressure on. If you're getting interviews, man, you're going to get a job. And also, I sent you that article on BlackRock.
Yeah.
Where does Tim Geithner go to get advice from Larry Fink at BlackRock? That's how important BlackRock is, Bob. Most of the phone calls, you know, to the outside world, that Tim Geithner made, you know, the highest number, 49 calls in a year and a half, every 11 days. He's calling the CEO of BlackRock.
Right, and it becomes apparent to me, Andy, before I lose you. You know, because we had an email the other day talking about a shadow government. You know, we don't just have a shadow government. We have a shadow economy.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, letting BlackRock determine economic policy is. It is a shadow economy.
Right. And number two on his bat phone, of course, is Robert Rubin.
Yep.
Beautiful. Robert Rubin, another predator. And also, just real quick, those smartphones, man, we can do that here. That's highly sophisticated. The articles I read, man, that takes a supply chain exactly like automobile manufacturing. That is just a multiplier effect in jobs and jobs and jobs. Apple really screwed this country bad.
Well, but remember, Steve Jobs despised the American worker. He said it himself.
Yes, he does. He does. He hated workers. He hated them. It seems like he hates America, the guy. I mean, talk about a guy.
Yep.
Constant greed, out for himself, and that's all that matters. But, yeah, if Brazil can do it, and we don't want Foxconn, of course, but if Brazil could do it, we could do it. But anyway, I'm glad that worked out with Peter B. He's a great dude, man. I guess that thing
will go up sometime soon. Either he said it's at up. The end of this week. Is it already up?
It's up. He told me. For me, I'm on a little delayed because I don't give him as much money, but it should come up. I'll be seeing it soon. I haven't seen it yet, but he did actually send me an email that his regular subscribers can get access to it now, his normal subscribers.
Excellent.
I'm kind of delayed.
Yeah, he goes out to like 30,000 people or something. It's just mind-blowing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I'm on the lower tier plan. I'm delayed like 30 days or something like that.
Well, thank you again for making that happen, Andy, and you have yourself a great evening.
Anyway.
All right. You take care, Andy.
All right, great. Keep up the great work, Bob. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye now. Our buddy Andy calling from California. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, this is another member of your California fan club.
Hey, what's up, man?
We spoke a couple of weeks ago on unmet needs and the part we thought that had to play in some of the greed that we see with the neocons. But another thought I was hoping to have a chance to bounce off you. While I think of it, though, before I do, I feel guilty. Sometimes I don't know when to call because I may get tied up 10 minutes or maybe an hour and a half, and I either run all my minutes off my phone or I'm costing you money. So there is a system by which your phone can be answered by a machine that says, leave your number, and as soon as it's your turn, we'll call you back. And
yeah, but who's going to make that call?
Oh, that's right. You have to be everything, don't you?
I do.
Well, anyway, it's a thought, because I don't know how much by minute it costs on the 877 line. Probably when it's across the country like that, it's a few pennies at least. But what has been troubling me for a long time, some of the crazy invasions, I think that the neocon tech types are able to do into our electronic systems, phones, computers, and I think in particular voting machines. It's been troubling me for a long time. You may recall that it's not something that's just popping into my head now, but one of the things I learned firsthand, very directly, was that if a big corrupt corporation wants to be able to rip the people off with no accountability, if that's their plan, if they make a big contribution to the Republican Party and to the Democratic Party, suddenly it's entered in the computer that they're a hands-off corporation. And if anybody complains of being ripped off, look the other way, get confused.
I don't think it's that exotic, simply because that would be something that would be discoverable in a litigation process. I think this is much more just a matter of the same plain old dirty political patronage, Dave, that has plagued this country for since its inception. It has just risen to a level of something approaching political critical mass. And we are either going to just go over the edge into full on empire style fascism, authoritarian plutocracy, or we're going to back away from it. And right now, the odds on backing away, I would not place a dollar bet on in a betting parlor.
Well, I don't know for sure where we're disagreeing on this. I hope you'd clarify it for me, because I don't like believing what I am believing, but I find the big ones, the Wells Fargo's, the Halliburton-type operations, Lockheed Martin, they want to make money by doing rip-offs, and they don't want any congressmen, senators, or agencies of the government spying into what they're doing, looking under the leaf. So I think that they do their thing. They pay off. In effect, they donate what campaign contributions. They're not looking just for honest government or good government.
No, they're looking for the exact opposite, Dave.
They want to be able to get special treatment and the right to do that.
They want access. And access gives them... All you've got to have is access. Once you've got access, you can get whatever you want. For instance, Sheldon Adelson is pumping all of his tens of millions into this because his special hard-on is Israel. That's his gig.
Yeah, yes, and so Israel...
And so he wants access to advance his Israel Uber Allah's agenda. That lunatic who was funding Rick Santorum, who is now pumping money into Mitt Romney's campaign. Well, he wants to protect the fetuses. And so he'll get access to make his fetus-protecting argument. On the other hand, if it's somebody like Monsanto or a coal thug or oil thugs, no, you don't have to have any special computer program to mark off a box. That's what your campaign manager's for.
Well, they know. Somebody in the office has to know that this particular bank has made the big contribution. They have, in effect, bought the right to do their thing without any interference that we are supposed to look at.
Absolutely, and that's what I'm saying. There doesn't have to be any manifest skullduggery or any electronic skullduggery to do this. This is easily accomplished with a back pat and a handshake.
All right, that's kind of more faith at your end than I would.
No, there's no faith. It's easier. It's easier to break the law. It's easier to be dirty this way.
Nothing's in the computer. It's just in a handshake, huh?
Yeah.
Because I watch those two go out.
Now, that as compared to, say, concerns about video game voting, those are completely different issues. I have no faith. I have no faith whatsoever, Dave, that when I toddle myself down to my polling place on a brisk November morning, I have no faith whatsoever, and no way of knowing.
No, and you know
whether my vote will be counted.
Many really good people, attorneys, accountants, and all, they want to try to make sure that it's honest, and they show up at the registrar's office on election day, and they position themselves, well, they're going to watch these computers doing their thing. Well, they see a computer, but they haven't clue one what's going on inside. And I am convinced that, you know, well, we've spoken, I think, a long time ago. There was in the last big one there when Bush and Gore, that there were little precincts that had 200 or 250 registered voters in that same
place. And there was 1,000 votes for Bush. Yeah, that I forget what county that was in Ohio, but yeah, it happened. And you know, the single best repository of all this information is Brad Friedman at bradblog.com.
Yes.
He knows more about this than anybody else in the country.
Yes.
And he keeps on top of it, and if a story breaks that is related to dummied up voting, he'll have it. And frankly, I don't just listen to Brad's. I know Brad. We've been talking to each other on the phone, and we've met once. And I mean, if Brad told me that it was raining money outside, I'd go out with a bucket, okay? Because it really would be.
Yes,
I believe Brad Friedman. Brad Friedman has incredible credibility with me.
Yes, I go back with him a long time, and that was the third person that was just mentioned. A mutual friend, Peter B. Collins, who used to have Brad on all the time, along with Deb Harris, who I'm sure you're familiar with, both of which can demonstrate, literally, this is how you rig a voting machine to flip as many votes as you want flipped, and they demonstrated.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to the Clint Curtis business.
Yeah.
It's like Jim just wrote in, and he said, what did I tell you years ago? Wall Street access, K Street access equals voting results access and results. And Jim closes by saying, duh.
Right. It was Brad who more or less discovered Clint Curtis for us and got him to tell his story there originally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that extends over because I watch two people go out on the stage of the university to debate, and what is it that they can't talk about? And that is to say, if both of them are members of a political party, two different political parties, but their party, which has accepted big contributions from special interests for their own purposes, then they can't talk about that. Nobody can mention. But you, sir, what do you think Halliburton expects out of you for all the money they have put in your pocket? What do you think Lockheed Martin...
No, but see, nobody's going to ask that question, Dave.
They aren't going to ask that question.
The for-profit media are never going to ask that question because they are tapped. They've got the tourniquet around their arm, and they've got the same sweet stuff flowing into their veins. Why do you think this horse race meme continues to persist in this election cycle? Why do you think the myth that we talked about so extensively last night, the myth of that undecided voter, continues to be such a driving force in this? How in God's name could you be undecided on the 18th day of October 2012 at the election, what, 19 days away?
No, that was the thing you said if you wanted to get a good seat in the university auditorium. I don't think anybody at this point.
No, but it extends beyond that. The undecided voters and the close race are entirely necessary in order for our utterly corrupt for-profit media system to continue to receive the windfall, the massive, massive windfall of money that is flowing out of the pockets into these millionaires, into the pockets of other millionaires. They're trading money up above the atmosphere that we breathe.
Well, it is, to me, and I hear it in your voice too, such a devastating reality that we're up against. If we want to believe we live in a democracy, and if enough of us show up and try to vote for the right person, that it will...
No, Dave, please stop. I'm not arguing with you, and I'm not being mean, but please, please don't ever on this program say that we live in a democracy. We don't. Not from the very moment this country was founded have we lived in a democracy. The Constitution itself was created to quell urges toward democracy in the several states. Okay? We don't have a democracy here. Democracy is an aspirational goal, not a fact of life. Democracy is something we can have if we work hard enough for it. But we do not have it now. One of the things that just goes through me like a dose of salt is to hear some politician, be they right or left, talking about in our democracy. They usually talk about it when they're complaining about, Iran or some country they deem to be benighted. There's no democracy here. None. Zero. Zilch. Zip. Nada.
Well, we can go down back to some of the speeches by Jefferson and Madison and Sidney Lincoln in his government of the people, by the people, for the people. That was a good, nice sounding message. It's something like...
But those were words said in furtherance of the maintenance of the status quo, okay? Of the Republican style of government that we do have. The government of the United States was modeled not on the Athenian democracy, Dave. The government of the United States was modeled on the Republican government of Rome. The bicameral form of government was not some new invention that Madison came up with. The bicameral form of legislature was taken from the two lawmaking bodies of ancient Rome, namely the Senate and what was called the plebs. Only they didn't call the House of Representatives the plebs. They called it the House of Representatives. And in each instance, the representatives and the senators were to be selected. Originally, the senators were to be selected by the oligarchy via the state governments, and there was to be direct election of the members of the House of Representatives. This was all done because they directly bogarted Roman government, and democracy was not a part of it.
Well, we had then no telegraph. No electronic zap. We've got the information across the country in a fraction of a second. So we did have to send people by horseback to go tell how we wanted our votes cast and things like that.
And you know what? Even when Washington, D.C. was nothing but a series of mud puddle alleys, there were people with money in their pockets standing at the side of those alleys, eating miserable dinners in boarding houses down the streets that those alleys were. And once the representative got away from his district and went to Washington, D.C., everything changed. A classic case in point is David Crockett. Now, this guy was elected from a Middle Tennessee district, and they were almost, the majority were certainly dirt farmers or slaves. But he saw right away what happened when he got to D.C. He was wined and dined, and there was plenty of liquor flowing around. One of the greatest pitfalls of a lack of intimate knowledge of American history is this notion that there was some golden age when there was democracy happening here, when, Dave, there never was.
Well, there did happen this. I believe there have been times in our history when we had the good fortune as a people to have in power some people that cared about the well-being of the people, not just the big money interests that had put money in their pocket. But I think we can see where there were times when Johnson, Truman, Roosevelt, for example, did make laws, did act on our behalf to try to see to it.
But enacting social policy in favor of the working class is not the same as democracy, Dave.
Well, it's something that correlates to me. It is something that, however they got there, these are people that are trying to do right by the working people and the poor, and not just there to act on behalf of those people who could afford to buy them, to pay them off. So how did they get there? How did we get a...
Well, in point of fact, some of the great society stuff was done not at the behest of constituencies, but in spite of them. If you look at the votes over things like the Civil Rights Act, you will see that it was done not because the folks back at home wanted it, but because the elected representatives knew that that was where this country had to go.
Right.
And again, that ain't democracy. Democracy, you know, we must be very careful about, on the other hand, we must be very careful about yearning for democracy, because, for instance, if you read Plato, Plato had nothing for democracy, because a democracy ordered the execution of his teacher Socrates. Because the democracy of Athens could not tolerate someone running around preaching love thine enemy any more than Palestine of 320 years later could.
Well, I'm one who believes that whatever form of government we might have in place, if, however they get there, we have people who have it in their heart to want to do the right thing for the people, then that kind of government will act to the betterment of humanity. And whatever kind of government you have, whether you call it republic or democracy or communist or whatever, if it's run by people who say, how do I stuff more money in my pocket? How do I exploit? How do I use and get for me and to hell with the people? Then that system is going to not work at all to benefit us. Our unfortunate plight now is that those who are in power are very much driven by and owned by Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and Standard Oil and that group that comprised...
And they, in turn, act in behalf of their shareholders. What we are talking about here, instead of democracy, Dave, I mean, you have just defined quite succinctly the essence of oligarchy. And that is what we are. We are an oligarchic empire. We don't have an emperor per se. Instead, every 4 years, we choose an imperial administrator.
I've seen it on the TV. There is a queen who's one of the small Polynesian countries who walks about with her people and stops and talks to the farmer, talks to the gardener. And what can we, the government, do to help benefit you? What do you need that isn't being met? And she returns with the intent to try to solve those problems on behalf of the people. So you may say, well, who wants a monarchy? That's a dictatorship. That you got somebody that's a good person, however she's in power, who's trying to do on behalf of the people the right thing. So I don't want to think that we would take the gamble that we could appoint a king and hope that the king would do the right thing. But
one, I have come to the conclusion that one of the worst things this country ever did was to pass the constitutional amendment that imposed term limits on the presidency. Because anytime you start talking about term limits, Dave, you start talking about the electorate conceding its authority. Because the term limits are supposed to happen at the ballot box. As long as the majority of the electors trust the work being done, and I say that neutrally, neither Democrat nor Republican. As long as the electorate trusts the work being done by their representative, they should feel free to keep that representative or remove that representative. And that goes up to and includes the President of the United States.
Right.
But that was ramrodded through by Republicans in the wake of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt because they were scared that they would never, ever again get back into the White House. And it was only by virtue of the fact that Harry Truman chose not to run again that they did get back in, and they got Eisenhower. And out of that presidency, what did we reap? We reaped the sorrow and misery that has plagued us to this day in the form of our relationship with the Middle East. Because it was in the Eisenhower administration that we decided we had some sort of divinely sanctioned right to go and screw with Iran. And the screwing that began with the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh plagues us to this day. Hey, Dave, I've got to run along, but it's been a good conversation, and I do appreciate it.
Always much appreciated with you, too, Bob.
You take care. Bye now. Our good buddy Dave, also calling from California. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Jeremy?
Hey, thanks for that slam on democracy. That's how I feel, too. I believe it's all smoke and mirrors.
Well, I don't intend it, Jeremy, as a slam.
Well, no, I don't mean it as a slam, but I mean saying that we're a democracy because we're not. People use that. You hear it all the time, like, well, this is why a democracy. You can vote for it. No, you really can't, but it's a nice thought.
There's one aspect of it that's very, very simple. If we were a democracy, we would be electing a president on November the 6th. Well, here's a hint. There is not a single person that is going to go to the polls who is going to vote directly for the President of the United States.
Right.
Because that anachronistic, elitist, plantation-owning concept of the Electoral College still controls the outcome to this day. And right. You know, there's that entire Rube Goldberg mechanism that lies behind it, you know, where votes can be thrown into the House of Representatives and blah, 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 blah. And you know, it's been played out over time. But the Electoral College still controls the selection of the president.
Until it goes to the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah.
Which should never happen in the first place either. But what I really was calling about, then you ticked me off when you told me that, you said that made sense. But today on NBC, actually it's tonight on the news, they brought up fracking. And NBC did their best to remain neutral, in which actually I guess they really didn't, because they had no one on the piece that was against it. It was all people in the town that were for it. And I want to say in this one small town in Ohio, I'm pretty sure I heard they made 88 families millionaires overnight over fracking. And all these people are so happy, and they see no real, well, it's worth the threat of poisoning or whatever. It was kind of disgusting.
Yeah,
really.
Well, the only thing I say to those 88 overnight millionaires is what's going to happen when you have to, when you need to distill that million into potable water.
Right, and I mean, some of these people sold off their inherited farmland, which they're running canning businesses off of, and bottling things for festivals, and I'm just shaking my head. But do they not want
anything? Look at the undercoverage of what's going on with the protests in Texas over the Keystone XL pipeline. I mean, there are abuses and horrors taking place down there. A grandmother was arrested and dragged off her own land. Reporters for the New York Times, simply trying to do the First Amendment business of covering it, have been arrested and dragged away.
There's definitely a news blackout in this country. And the corporations do it, we all realize that, that we don't hear a tenth of what we need to hear for that same reason, because we need to hear it. And if we heard it, I do believe that some of Malloy's theories of 25 million in the streets would not be a problem, even 100 million maybe.
I don't know if I can go that far with you, Jeremy, and for this reason. I referenced this last night that... George Lakoff has told us time and time and time again that you must touch people's hearts. It does not matter how many convincing statistics that you have. You must first touch their hearts. And I don't know. And I have some first-hand experience with this, because a big part of what I do here is to try to touch people's hearts enough to get them to care about what's going on here in Appalachia. And the Horn family, being the Horn family, they are open to it. But, you know, how many? Well, you know, the AIC Act that we're working on so desperately is literally aimed at saving lives here. But this is a country that has been inured, has been poisoned into thinking that we must first and foremost consider every question as a matter of economics before anything else. So if I say, let's stop blowing up the mountains in Appalachia so babies won't be born unable to breathe, the immediate response is, yeah, but what about our jobs? Implicit in that is, screw that baby.
I can see the point, Bob. You're right. You have to be able to touch people's emotions and touch their heart, which... I think, like you said, most of the Horn people are open to that. Other people, what's in it for me, really, in the end?
Yeah, the 88 millionaires, right?
Right. And it's like I said before, with the AIC Act, I realize how all this stuff affects everybody on a global scale, whether they want to think so or not. And like my point from before, where the dinosaurs piss in the same water we drink today. So no matter what they do to the water, it'll keep cycling around the world. To rain, to the ocean, to everywhere. We're
right. The only thing is, we have finally, as humans, developed a means and method whereby we can make it so that the water that circulates may never safely be consumed by another living thing.
Right. And we're probably killing off more species than we've ever discovered.
Yeah.
And that's a huge trickle-down effect. Pretty soon we're going to be the species.
Right. That's another one of those frames or talking points that I reject, and I wish this was a bigger soapbox, because I would like to get the so-called environmental community. I would like to get the folks who talk about these kinds of things so passionately and with such great concern to pretty please stop talking about we're killing the planet. I think I mentioned this earlier. We are not killing the planet. We are killing the ability of human beings to exist on the planet.
Right. The planet will always be until the sun burns it out.
Right.
We're killing our ability to live here.
Right. What we may be doing is modifying the planet for some race of space aliens who can drink toxic hydrocarbon poisoned water just fine. Then they're going to love it here. Or maybe the cockroaches are going to adapt. But, that's not killing the planet.
It kind of poke fun at the people like me who think we've been visited by UFOs. Maybe they're here stirring the pot to see when they can harvest it.
Right. Well, no, I remember that movie that Charlie Sheen was in years and years and years ago, where the aliens were running... plants in the remote corners of Mexico that were just periodically generating massive amounts of greenhouse gas to heat up the planet so it would be warm enough for when the alien overlords arrived.
Right.
So no, I mean I'm prone to that kind of thing. But the point is, you know, even if it's the 6 foot tall race of highly evolved sentient cockroaches, you know, imagine the assembly lines that they'll build.
With all their arms?
Right. You know, they only got to stand on two of them once they learn to walk upright. But you know, at that point in time, we're going to be to them what the dinosaurs were to us. And we're talking about millions of years. So, I don't know. I was thinking earlier today, speaking of science fiction, some enterprising scientist, you know, we're constantly discovering now stars that have planets circling them. Some enterprising scientist needs to name one of those stars Kolob. and we need to get the Mormons to get busy building their spaceship.
Yeah, Romney can put him on a big step that way. He's got lots of money.
Yeah, well, he's got spaceship money. And, you know, goodbye now. Goodbye.
Him, Glenn Beck, a couple of the other followers can take off with him.
Yeah, look at it. Well, and you know, and then we can salt the data a little bit and say, and the planet around Kolob seems to have a great deal of hydrocarbon matter on it. And all the oil companies will go, too.
Yeah, we can always dream. Hopefully it'll happen someday.
And we just, you know... And then those of us who are left, you know, we're just like the end of Jim Stafford's Wildwood Weed, where we say, and we just sat there and waved, sitting there on that bag of seeds. Y'all come back now. Y'all don't come back now. You hear?
Yeah.
I mean, and sometimes I just feel like that's the only way we're going to survive.
And I totally agree. I want to bring up one last thing. I see we're getting short on time here. I heard Brad, I think it was Brad Freeman a couple of years ago on Malloy on like a April Fool's Day or something. He was on there talking about the voting machines. Yes, the video game voting machines. And he had mentioned how the makers of them, I can't think what the biggest one is. It's
Diebold, ES&S, Sequoia.
It's like a team of those. Yeah, I think it was Diebold at the time, had put out some sort of a challenge to Harvard hackers. We think our machines are hack-proof. So Harvard guy kind of laughed at that. He's like, okay, whatever. Took the challenge on. Broke it overnight. One of the machines was set up so that one guy was winning. The next morning, the other guy was totally winning with every single vote. The other machine was playing fucking Pac-Man.
Yeah. Not surprised. Not surprised in the least.
So I'm not surprised, but I've always been impressed by that fact when Brad said that, and I've always
what you raise there, Jeremy, is there's a hierarchy here. If you go to the polls and you have a choice between a video game voting machine and an optical scan machine, always choose the optical scan machine.
Because it
is the lesser of two evils, but it still can't be validated. You've just got a slightly better chance of getting your vote counted.
Like I said, thankfully we still use paper ballots here, so not yet.
Devoutly to be wished. Jeremy, it is good to hear from you, my friend. I thank you very much for calling.
Sure. Have a good night.
Bye now. From Vermont, that's Jeremy. A closing word from our buddy Jack in Shreveport. Under the subject line, poisoning the water. By polluting the water, the wealthy can make it such that we must buy unpolluted water from them. And it will be just one more thing that we need to pay for every day, yet they can afford without so much as a thought. And therein lies the essence of so-called conservatism, which isn't, which should more properly be called regressivism. Because everything that they hope to put onto us winds up being some form of either governmental or capitalized regressive taxation. Governments are not the only things that tax. Corporations tax too. When big food threatens that every family in California will pay $400 extra per month if they have to put on what's got GMO in it and what doesn't, what the corporations are saying is we are going to impose upon you a regressive tax of our own choosing that you will feel as middle or lower class far more profoundly than will Arnold. Okay? Because that number, $400 extra per year, that doesn't matter a hill of beans to somebody making a half $1 million or $1 million a year. But it means a hell of a lot to somebody making $20,000. That's where we are. That's where we are. Listen, program note. I may not be on the air tomorrow. This is what is called Bridge Day weekend here in almost level West Virginia. This is the one time a year when the New River Gorge Bridge, not far from here, is opened up to tourists, many of whom like to jump off of it wearing parachutes. You'll never catch me doing that. But tomorrow night is the kickoff to it, and it is something that over the years my family and I have gotten together to go out and do. So with your kind acquiescence, if it is not pouring down rain as it did this afternoon, we may go out tomorrow night. If it's pouring down rain, I'm right here. So just to let you know where everything stands. Thanks, all of you, for all you do. Thank you for the massive fundraising effort last night. It is so profoundly appreciated. Onward toward meeting October's fundraising goal. And we are not that far from it. And the minute we do that, I announce on the program that it's happened, and you, by God, have beaten the Swede once again. And we'll go forward and maybe, just maybe, start trying to build a little bit of cushion that the horn can exist on. Thank you all so sincerely. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room, our news ninja, news ninjas, Jean and Susan. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to Agnes for her ongoing help with the show posts every day over at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Thanks for everything that John Fox does to help keep me sane and keep all the little technical gremlins from driving me running into the night. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. 10 years now that Ben Birch has been making internet radio of a progressive and liberal nature available via the White Rose. 10 years, and he's never sent a bill. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT.org. ACHEACT, ACHEACT.org. Go there to learn how you can be an active part in helping create a real future in Appalachia. You know, your fellow Americans. And always, always, always. Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
My buddy Rick Smith is next on the horn.